Healthcare Administrator Wendy Welch noted, "We're not victims here, except for when it comes to Purdue Pharma, but when one of us makes a mistake, it tends to be a fatal one." I found hope in the stories of Tyson's staff and patients as I set out in multiple visits to discern what happened after the volunteer doctors departed for the urban enclaves and the politicians and pundits went home. I felt hope as I witnessed Tyson, a bubbly, every curl in place blonde, manage her workaday free clinic as she seamlessly steered her rattling 2001 Winnebago through Southwest Virginia's serpentine roads, juggling phone calls from nurses, patients, and the media alike, wearing high-heeled rhinestone-studded sandals. With her sorghum-thick accent, Tyson was camera-ready and thoroughly put together each time we met, except once, when mascara smudged her doctor's coat. I would find out soon enough why she'd been crying for days, and it wasn't because the battery on her Winnebago had just conked out. The nonprofit's marketing manager was displaced with the battery booster to give us a jump, while Tyson's husband offered real-time jump-starting counsel via FaceTime. It was a fitting state of affairs for what happens after the out-of-state Ram do-gooders depart, and Tyson's grant-funded health wagon staff of 20 is left to tend to the health needs of the region's uninsured. The program is called the Health Wagon because it was founded in 1980 by a Catholic nun and medical missionary named Sister Bernie Kenny, now retired, who first provided care out of the back of her red Volkswagen Beetle. At our first stop, Tyson treated the swollen wrist of a substitute teacher whose pay had just been reduced from $70 to $56 a day. She was a casualty of school district depopulation and austerity, measures that included closing two schools in the town of Appalachia, one of which was now a food bank. In St. Paul, where our RV was presently stalled, the middle school roof had become so tattered that buzzards had descended on it a few months earlier to eat the rotting tiles. With no money for repairs, school administrators resorted to temporary measures to divert the vultures, erecting giant inflatable tube men, those silly beacons you see waving from car dealerships. The 54-year-old teacher hadn't had insurance in decades, not since she was pregnant and qualified for Medicaid. Her husband, a former Walmart worker disabled by a series of strokes, was on Medicare. Because Virginia hadn't approved the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion, she patched together free coverage at RAM events and occasional visits to Tyson's mobile unit when it came to town. She had to be practically dying before she went to see her family doctor, who accepted cash at a discount rate of $63 per visit. In a state with an increasingly flimsy safety net, people like Tyson had been left to clean up the politicians' mess. As the healthcare debate over repeated attempts to repeal the ACA raged in Washington, and opioid activists waited for President Trump to declare the epidemic an official national emergency to free up immediate federal disaster relief funds for cities and states, between patients, Tyson followed the machinations on her phone, fuming as she scrolled. A devoutly religious wife and mother from nearby Coburn, she was finding it hard to remain optimistic. In our first interview, she'd been distraught over the recent death of a 42-year-old patient caused by untreated hepatitis C. Though he hadn't used or injected drugs for 8 years, he could not afford to see a specialist, and by the time treatment could be arranged, the damage was already done and he couldn't overcome it, said his father, who owns a 27-acre cemetery. The man buried his son near his office so he could visit him daily, he said. He invited me to tour the Wise County graveyard, where he offered to point out the scores of people he'd personally buried thanks to OxyCoffin, as the pills are now known here. Months later, Tyson found herself crushed by a repeat in the continuing tragedy. In spite of 24/7 news cycles and a dense web of interconnectedness, here was one more death that gained no media traction and inspired zero public action. She could give all the interviews she wanted during the month of Ram, but the truth was that the extent of the suffering here garnered very little attention outside the spectacle of the annual healthcare event. Unremarked on were the slow simmering and increasingly common stories of people for whom no treatment could be secured. This time Tyson was crying about Reggie Stanley, 45, who died in a Charlottesville hospital while awaiting a liver transplant after 12 years of untreated hepatitis C. This patient was such a good person. He did make the wrong decisions initially, Tyson said, of Stanley's IV drug use, but he'd been sober for several years. She tried desperately to get him into treatment, but like 90% of her patients, he was uninsured, and Tyson could not persuade a gastroenterologist to take him on as charity care. She has since had success dispensing free medication provided by the company that makes Harmony, the expensive hepatitis-curing drug. By the time Stanley made it to a liver transplant list, his disease was too far advanced. She said, "You can fix it upstream when it's affordable, or you can wait till they present back in the ER with stage 4 cancer or cirrhosis, and they still need extended hospital stays," Tyson said. "It's a drain on the system no matter what, so why can't we fix it upstream?" Tyson kept looking at Stanley's obituary on her phone, which included a photo of him beaming in his Clintwood High graduation gown. "He was a great guitar player, great singer, and a good soul who was loved by many," one of the guestbook mourners wrote. The region's health department director, Dr. Sue Cantrell, the same one who'd warned state supervisors about the epidemic 2 decades before, only to have her pleas dismissed as a, quote, regional problem, was slowly making inroads. With the Scott County, Indiana HIV epidemic still in mind, Cantrell had been holding town hall meetings in the coalfield counties throughout the summer of 2017 to sound the alarm. Though Virginia had recently passed legislation paving the way for syringe exchange programs, every legislator in the coal fields had voted against the bill, citing widespread local law enforcement concerns, even though crime historically has not risen in communities with access to clean needles. Across the border in West Virginia, a 2015 syringe exchange had resulted in lowered overdose deaths and 5 times greater access to treatment and disease prevention services. Cantrell was hoping to arrange a visit from a West Virginia police chief to talk to local authorities, and her staff was already teaching users to clean their syringes between injections, giving out Clorox packets and plastic cups. She sometimes offered free food to entice patients both to be tested and to return for the results. The RAM clinic offered free hepatitis C testing for the first time. A pharmacy professor estimated that 75% of IV drug users in the region have contracted it and have no idea, and she handed out take-home naloxone kits with training to almost 400 people. In a rural area like this, just trying to get people to their appointments is huge, Cantrell told me. 2 patients in the MAT clinic she runs in nearby Lee County, Virginia, either hitchhike or walk to their appointments, some from a distance of more than 5 miles. She'd floated the idea of turning some of the area's subsidized housing units into, quote, clean living facilities with wraparound services and support group offerings, not unlike substance-free college dorms. "We need to support this as a chronic disease the same as we support cancer and other diseases," Cantrell said. "Not just evidence-based treatment and drug prevention programs, but broadening it to meaningful education that leads to jobs with a living wage so there are options to stay in the area or to leave." At the narcotics farm in Lexington, Kentucky, researchers had once referred to the latter as the geographic cure. The idea of moving away from the site of addiction's onset appealed to younger people who grew up among addicted family members, as well as to the recovering addicts themselves, and it had worked for some, like many of the returning Vietnam soldiers. But opioids are much more available today than they were then, summonable by text or via online crypto markets, aka the dark web, and vastly more potent. The biggest lesson of the science behind drug addiction is that alternate reinforcers are essential, Nancy D. Campbell, the narcotics farm historian, told me. If you want to keep people away from drugs and drug-related crime, you have to have rewarding activities. It's work. It's play. It's an emphasis on the kinds of activities and relationships that people build their lives around. If we don't do something to rebuild these communities, I don't see this current drug configuration ebbing in the way that drug waves of the past historically have. The question echoed louder by the day in rural America. How do you inspire hope in a middle school boy whose goal in life is to become a drawer, like his parents before him and their parents before them? Did a president who bragged about winning a swing state, telling the president of Mexico, I won New Hampshire because New Hampshire is a drug-infested den. Win because voters genuinely thought he could fix it, or because too many people were too numbed out to vote? Voters should judge politicians at all levels on the literal health of their communities, lawyer Brian Stevenson explained. And while most Americans support federal financing of health care, and even a slim majority approves of single payer, those reforms will likely remain political non-starters until more voters begin defining themselves in contrast to the billionaire class holding sway in Washington. Also needed are more efforts to court non-white voters, including Hispanics, of whom 74% are currently registered to vote, African Americans, 69%, and Asian Americans, 57%. You've got too many leaders just not responding to problems, Stevenson said. Think about HIV, with smoking, with Zika. You had this energetic leadership from people who were saying, we're going to win this. The mindset of this is unacceptable has to be brought into the way we think about addiction and the opioid epidemic. But part of the problem now is we're so hopeless that we don't try very hard. America's approach to its opioid problem is to rely on Battle of Dunkirk strategies, leaving the fight to well-meaning citizens and their fishing vessels and private boats, when what's really needed to win the war is a full-on Normandy invasion. Rather than puritanical platitudes, we need a new deal for the drug addicted. But the recent response has been led not by visionaries, but by campaigners spewing rally-style bunk about border walls and just say no. And the appointment of an attorney general who believes the failed war on drugs should be amped up, not scaled back. Asked in August 2017 why he hadn't taken his own commission's recommendation to label the epidemic a national emergency, President Trump dodged the question. He said he believed the best way to keep people from getting addicted or overdosing was by talking to youth and telling them, no good, really bad for you in every way. A few days later, he seemed to change his mind, saying he would make the emergency official, even as he remained tethered to a law and order approach. But months later, he still had not followed through. When the so-called emergency was re-trumpeted in an October 2017 press conference, Trump sounded bold and even hopeful, but his ballyhoo fell short of an official declaration and included no additional treatment funding. At the time, 7 Americans were dying of overdose every hour. To be fair, the crisis had been cruelly ignored by both sides of the political aisle. The Obama administration had also been slow to address the crisis and tepid when it did. Caroline Jean Acker, the historian who is also a harm reduction activist, told me she was scolded during a 2014 NIDA meeting for championing needle exchange and naloxone distribution after a speaker attempted to separate, quote, good addicts or people who became medically addicted from the illicit or, quote, bad users, as if there were no fluidity between the two. She said, the worst thing for politicians, I was told, was for them to appear they were being soft on drugs. Even under Obama, federal substance abuse and mental health services administration employees were told not to use the term harm reduction, she said, sighing. No matter where I turned in Central Appalachia, the biggest barriers to treatment remained cultural. Stigma pervaded the hills and hollows, repeating itself like an old-time ballad, each chorus featuring a slightly different riff. At the Ram event in Wise, a kerfuffle erupted when a local judge volunteering at the event accused a pharmacist of giving Narcan training to a local Boy Scout troop without their parents' permission. She claimed the kids would party harder knowing they had Narcan to revive them. Just ridiculous, one trainer told me. But across the region, where it seemed every family had at least one soul crusher of a story, it would take more than one fairground debate to convince people that harm reduction was necessary to save lives, even as the region had the worst hepatitis C rate in the state. 1/3 of children in Central Appalachia now lived with a non-parent adult, and 96% of the adopted kids weren't orphaned. They'd been removed from their drug-addicted parents by social workers. At another healthcare wagon event, a man overdosed on meth in the parking lot while his friends took off running up the mountain, according to the responding EMT, who recognized a familiar, unconscious face. repeats, as Giles Sarton refers to many of his overdose calls, telling me, "It's rare you'll get somebody who's just now getting hold of it." Sarton, 21, has been an EMT since the 10th grade. He made the decision to train the day he was sitting in a freshman English class and heard the double thump of two classmates seated behind him hitting the floor. They'd overdosed on OxyContin during a lesson on grammar and punctuation. "Last week, I Narcan'd the same person for the fourth time," Sarton said. When the man woke up, he punched Sarton's EMT partner and broke his nose. He'd been speedballing painkillers with meth, which makes users paranoid and gives them ridiculous strength. It was such a problem that Sarton's rescue squad had to adopt a new protocol. Even though people could die, they waited now for police to arrive before they went inside the patient's homes. "There's some communities where we're like an ice cream truck," Sarton said of the ambulance. "They'll try to steal our needles, our gloves, everything, especially in the Lee County hamlets of Keokie and St. Charles." When I explained that my book began with OxyContin abuse in Lee County in the late 90s, Sarton cut me off with a warning. "Ma'am, there are spots in St. Charles where I would advise you not to be there at night. If they catch you and don't know you well, I don't know." Tyson had revised the Health Wagon safety procedures, too. Whereas in Lebanon, she tends to set her RV up outside a Food City grocery or near the town square in St. Paul, she has learned to avoid residential neighborhoods in smaller communities. In the former coal camp of Clinchco, a close call had persuaded her to switch locales from a neighborhood to the police station parking lot. Some neighbors had rushed to her RV, screaming and banging on the door for help. Tyson recalled, "We get to their trailer, and in the living room, we get ready to work on the first person we see on the floor, but that wasn't even who they were talking about. The real patient was in the rear room, they were told, but her body was already growing cold." Meanwhile, others in the trailer were screaming at Health Wagon staffers to get the F out of here. "I still stand by what we did, trying to revive her, but the dynamics here are changing, and you can no longer just go blindly in," said Tyson, who was genuinely afraid during the exchange. Even law enforcement tightened up procedures. In 2017, the DEA recommended that first responders wear safety goggles, masks, and even hazmat suits to avoid skin contact with fentanyl and other powerful synthetics after reports of officers having to be Narcan'd when they inadvertently brushed up against them on calls. But these guidelines came way too late for caregivers in the coal fields. Tyson's life-and-death scare in Clinchco took place more than a decade earlier, in 2006. As a Lebanon prevention leader put it in a recent town hall meeting called Taking Our Communities Back, "We are pioneers when it comes to this drug epidemic. We can tell people what will happen in their communities in 20 years because it's already happened here to us. We are the canaries in the coal fields." If it sounds like alarmist anti-drug hyperbole, a version of Nixon's speech identifying drug abuse as public enemy number one, it's not. University of Pittsburgh Public Health Dean Don Burke recently published a study forecasting the epidemic spread. Charting drug overdose deaths going back to 1979, he added a new wrinkle to the work of Anne Case and Angus Deaton, the economist who pointed out the soaring deaths of despair among midlife white Americans. Drug overdose deaths had doubled every 8 years over that time. 300,000 Americans had died of overdose in the past 15 years, and lacking dramatic interventions, the same number would die in just the next five. The numbers by themselves are disturbing, but more disturbing is the pattern, a continuous, exponential, upward-sloping graph, Burke told me in 2017. A year before, more than 100 Americans a day were dying from opioid overdose. Some epidemiologists were predicting the toll would spike to 250 a day as synthetic opioids became more pervasive. Opioids are now on pace to kill as many Americans in a decade as HIV/AIDS has since it began, with leveling off projections tenuously predicted in a nebulous far-off future, sometime after 2020. In past epidemics, as the public perception of risk increased, experimentation declined, and awareness worked its way into the psyche of young people who came to understand Don't mess with this shit, not even a little bit, as another public health professor put it. But that message has not yet infiltrated the public conscience. What about the more than 2.6 million Americans who are already addicted? Will the nation simply write them off as expendable lowlifes, as Van Zee's patients still believed? My hope is that there is an end in sight, Burke told me, some natural limit or some policy where we deflect the curve downward. But even in states where downturns have intermittently appeared, such as in Florida following the crackdown on pill mills, eventually those places snap back to the curve, and we don't know why, he said. In the carefully couched words of an academic, Burke suggested that the war on drugs should be overhauled, with input gathered from other countries, including Portugal, that had decriminalized drugs and diverted public monies from incarceration to treatment and job creation. He wondered whether drug cartels were the economy's new invisible hand, a modern-day Adam Smith creeping around America's suburbs, cities, and small towns, proffering stamped bags of dope. The Economist had assumed the free market economy would operate efficiently as long as everyone was able to work for his or her own self-interest, but he had not foreseen the elevation of rent-seeking behavior, the outsized greed of pharmaceutical companies and factory-closing CEOs, and the creation of a class of people who were unable to work. In 2017, 2 decades after OxyContin erupted in Lee County, Virginia's Board of Medicine ordered that, to prevent doctor shopping, all doctors were to check the drug monitoring system every time they issued a prescription. This mandate arrived at the same time new CDC figures showed that residents of 2 rural Virginia towns had been prescribed more opioids per person than any other place in the country. The top locality was Martinsville, and the 4th was Galax, the small cities where my book Factory Man was largely set. As far behind as Virginia had been in its initial response, state health department officials were now working hard to expand MAT as well as to crack down on its abuse. The expansion was modeled after a Suboxone clinic in rural Lebanon called High Power, where a younger version of Art Van Zee, Dr. Hughes Melton, set up practice in 2000 because he wanted to treat the underserved. Melton was helping direct the state's response to the opioid crisis. Among his initiatives was a new statewide push for syringe exchange and some tighter controls on MAT prescribing. His wife, Sarah Melton, a pharmacy professor and naloxone trainer, hadn't just given training sessions to more than 4,000 doctors about the perils of opioids. She'd turned in a fair number for overprescribing them, too. The Meltons were so busy that often the only times I could interview them were at night or when they were in their cars. It was in their high-power clinic that several patients had first explained the diversion and abuse of buprenorphine to me, a practice harm reduction proponents elsewhere in the country dismissed every time I brought it up. Finding a balance between treating and perpetuating addiction had been pursued in the United States since the 1800s, when doctors used morphine to wean patients from laudanum, then later used heroin to get patients off morphine. Soldiers' disease had sparked a period of stern prohibition in the Harrison Act and eventually the war on drugs. Our wacky culture can't seem to do anything in a nuanced way, explained Dr. Mark Fishman, a Johns Hopkins researcher and MAT provider. While Fishman believed buprenorphine, methadone, and naltrexone were all imperfect solutions, they remain, scientifically speaking, the best death prevention tools in the box. He said, I apologize for my white-coated, nerdy scientist colleagues who have not invented better yet. I get it. The naysayers would be more open to MAT if its proponents would more openly acknowledge the drawbacks of maintenance drugs, significant relapse rates when patients stop treatment, for instance, instead of portraying them as a kind of perfect chemical fix, Fishman argued. The explosive costs of addiction-related illness will eventually force health systems to integrate addiction treatment into general health care, he predicted, including a smoother transition of overdose patients from hospital ERs to outpatient MAT. Too often, we're still giving them Narcan, then sending them along with a tired old Xerox of AA meeting phone numbers and telling them, have a nice life, he said. In a treatment landscape long dominated by 12-step philosophy, Only a slim minority of opioid addicts achieve long-term sobriety without the help of MAT, Fishman reminded me. He said, AA is not a scalable solution in an epidemic like this, and most opioid addicts just can't do it without MAT. In the Appalachian Bible Belt, a blend of MAT and 12-step programs seem to work best, which is why Art Van Zee and Sister Beth Davies still communicate daily about their patients, the nun letting the doctor know, for instance, when a shared patient suffers a personal setback, like a death in the family or a job loss. It had happened in the spring of 2017 with one of their longtime patients, Susan, not a real name, whose brother died of overdose. Then a few months later, Sister Beth emailed me that it had happened again. Another of Susan's brothers died of overdose, the youngest, whom she'd practically raised, Sister Beth said. The loss is tremendous. Among Susan's 10 siblings, only 3 had managed not to become opioid addicted, although one of the 3 was a pill dealer who didn't himself use, Susan had told me. She'd been in Van Zee's Suboxone program for 6 years and was now transitioning off disability via a program called Ticket to Work. She was putting in 12-hour shifts as a nursing home licensed practical nurse and going to the local community college to earn her registered nurse degree. Some of my family's like, why don't you just keep your disability check and stay home, she said. And I'm like, I've always wanted to go to school to be a nurse, and I can't make it on $740 a month. And besides, you just feel so much better about yourself when you work. Asked how the epidemic had changed her community, Susan sighed and told me it was now just an ingrained part of the culture. Her 15-year-old son believes the only way to avoid its perils is to move away. I can't live here, Mom, he told her. There's nothing here but drugs and nursing homes. The first time Susan saw Van Zee, he spent 2 hours with her, learning her medical history, including the details of her addiction and childhood abuse. She'd recently had surgery for lung cancer, and he did not make her feel like crap for continuing to smoke, though he suggested she stop. The members of her 12-step support group, the one led by Sister Beth, liked to joke, when you go to Van Zee's office, you might as well take a pillow and a blanket and a book because you're going to wait there a long time. They worry, though, about what they will do if something happens to the 70-year-old doctor and the 83-year-old nun. There's so many of us who would just be lost, Susan said. Van Zee was still working 16-hour days, much to Sue Ellis' chagrin. He was still conferring daily with Sister Beth over their growing roster of opioid use disorder patients, now the preferred term, not counting the 150 people on his waiting list, either on the phone or via email multiple times a day. Van Zee told me his greatest fear now was of being hit by an intoxicated driver while he jogged the winding roads, not because he feared his own death, but because where then would his patients go? Nationwide, attitudes about the drug addicted were shifting, faster in urban settings than rural. At the edge of Boston's South End, in a neighborhood some derisively called Methadone Mile, I stood in the low light of a homeless shelter clinic where users converged on a former conference room to be medically monitored as they rode out their heroin highs, often staggering in, propped between friends. In the facility's public restrooms, a clever maintenance worker had rigged reverse motion detectors that sounded visual and audible alarms to summon help if a person hadn't moved for 4 minutes. The initiatives were the brainchild of the shelter's medical director, who had sometimes tripped over bodies on her way to work, some of them having been fatally struck by cars. Dr. Jesse Gaeta's goal in opening supportive place for observation and treatment inside the shelter was to keep users alive until they were ready to be funneled into treatment, as well as to separate them from those in the homeless community already in recovery. Almost a third of the shelter's clients have opioid use disorder. But the brownstone-filled neighborhood was rapidly gentrifying, and the cultural obstacles, even in liberal Boston, were significant. Neighbors were worried that Spot would just attract more heroin users, dirty needles, and crime. Many accused Gaeta and her staff of enabling continued drug use. The project got the neighbors' reluctant blessing, but only after Gaeta invited community leaders and officials to the shelter and showed them what would happen in the small 10-recliner room. Over the course of more than 50 neighborhood meetings, she said, I got my ass kicked, basically. But many skeptics were won over when they realized she was treating the problems that were already happening outside indoors. In a program that didn't even keep patients' names on file, a strategy called low threshold to build trust, staffers monitored those who stumbled in on heroin combined with an increasing multiplicity of other drugs. The spot room was the first place where skittish rape victims would let GATA administer proactive treatments for sexually transmitted illness as they tentatively told her their stories in an adjoining kitchenette. Only then would they allow her to stanch the bleeding brought on by forced sodomy with a gun or by duct tape ripped from their mouths. Even in a mission-based organization, GATA said, there's still so much stigma around how we should treat addiction. You have to constantly fight this notion that we shouldn't wrap our arms around people who don't want treatment. Everywhere in America, it was painstaking to walk skeptics through the social, criminal, and medical benefits of helping the least of their brethren. But it was worth it, even if you had to get your ass kicked. In Appalachia, harm reduction was very slowly making inroads. In Lebanon, Virginia, where anti-MAT drug court workers had once been castigated by harm reduction proponents, Judge Michael Moore's hair had turned from salt and pepper to white in the year since I'd first interviewed him. But the top Russell County prosecutor had recently signed off on allowing the drug court's first Vivitrol participant, a 30-year pill addict who admitted she could not stop abusing buprenorphine. Moore praised the prosecutor's decision and viewed it as a harbinger of greater sensitivity in the criminal justice system to the realities of addiction. Half the probationers from his regular circuit court docket were now on Suboxone, and he said, "We do see good things with it." If his own kids were addicted, he told me, he too would want the option of MAT. Last fall, the governor declared opioids an epidemic, and I was like, are you kidding me? We've had the epidemic since 2002, Moore said. One of his present drug court participants, in fact, was born dependent on the drugs. It's really discouraging and scary, he said, because what kid, 16 or 17, doesn't know that opiates are addictive? They can see it in their family, so how can they not know? And yet they take them anyway. And there are parents out here just like me, or better, who have drug-addicted kids. The local schools had recently adopted new prevention models after studies showed kids were more likely to use drugs after DARE. One advocate told me she remembered her classmates sharpening the don't off their DARE pencils so they actually read, do drugs. A new school policy diverted first-time juvenile offenders into treatment instead of expulsion or jail. On Thursday nights, Judge Moore helped serve dinners to participants in a 12-step program at a local church. He also persuades his friends in the community, from fast food managers to local contractors, to hire his drug court participants. At a recent jury orientation, Moore's bailiff was approached by two boys, ages 4 and 5. Neil Smith thought they were the grandchildren of a potential juror, but it turned out they were only temporarily with him as foster children, and they were looking for a permanent parent, a fact that became clear when the boys took one look at the bailiff's uniform and asked him, "Will you be our daddy?" Smith is on the far end of middle-aged, a kindly-looking sort. Both his parents worked in the mines, and they grew a 12-acre plot of tobacco on the side near the hamlet of Cleveland. His first memory of the judge was from when they were both kids. He remembered an adolescent Michael Moore getting on the same Russell County school bus that he rode, his face obscured by an armload of books, his bright future laid out before him. One of the truest things I heard in my reporting came from David Avruk, a Baltimore therapist who works with a largely homeless heroin-addicted clientele. In his experience, the base problem wasn't a dearth of harm reduction, but an economic structure that created more foster kids and fewer Michael Moores. Avrick said, "The more we talk about the epidemic as an individual disease phenomenon or a moral failing, the easier it is to obfuscate and ignore the social and economic conditions that predispose certain individuals to addiction. The fix isn't more Suboxone or lectures on morality, but rather a reinvigorated democracy that provides a pathway for meaningful work with a living wage for everybody. Judge Moore asked me, 3 times in one sitting, what I had learned from my reporting that he could feel hopeful about. He chuckled as he said, "I can't wait to read your book because then maybe we'll know what to do." But he seemed closer to tears than laughter. I told him what Suella Kobach had said more times than I could count. The answer is always community. I told him about Teresa Tyson's health wagon and Sue Cantrell's commitment to stopping the spread of hepatitis C. The elusive gap between law enforcement and healthcare seemed as if it were finally beginning to close, I explained, even in a few remote Appalachian towns. I described a faith-based treatment center in nearby Bristol that had just turned a donated former nursing home into a rehab with 240 beds. Geared to housing addicted people, veterans, aging out foster kids, and ex-offenders getting out of jail, it had been brought to fruition by Bristol Recovery Center Director Bob Garrett, who had spent 3 years forging collaborations with local courts, police, churches, and social service agencies. Participants would eventually pay to live in the center, nestled in a peaceful wooded compound, after they found jobs with the center's help. At first, Garrett told me, he wasn't going to allow participants to be on MAT. But he changed his mind after serving on a community coalition spearheaded by East Tennessee State University public health professor Robert Pack. Since then, he's preached the benefits of evidence-based treatment to churches across the state at dinners and presentations on addiction. He told me, "We want to show the addicted that they're loved and cared about, and we're trying to teach the lay folk they're not really bad people, and that's a sin doesn't really work." I told Judge Moore finally the PACS Coalition, an alliance of mental health and substance abuse administrators who call themselves the working group, had just scored another coup. Of all the upstart recovery programs I had surveyed in my reporting, this collaboration represented the strongest model for thwarting governmental rigidity and bureaucratic indifference to the crisis, and it had the potential to be replicated elsewhere. In a rural town between Johnson City and Kingsport, Tennessee, the Alliance was about to open a treatment clinic called Overmountain Recovery. It was deliberately named Overmountain for the disparate group of local farmers and frontiersmen called the Overmountain Men who beat back the British in the Battle of Kings Mountain, turning the tide in the Revolutionary War. And recovery because the treatment is meant to go beyond MAT to include group and individual counseling, yoga, and other alternative therapies, plus job training support. Though the outpatient clinic would eventually offer Suboxone, it would predominantly be a methadone clinic because methadone is cheaper and harder to divert. Participants drink the liquid daily in front of a nurse. And the nearest methadone facility in the region was over a mountain some 60 miles away. "We would not have pulled this off without the working group," said Pack, who began his addiction research after losing a dear friend to opioid-related suicide in 2006. With the backing of his university, the region's nonprofit hospital corporation, and the state's mental health agency, Overmountain was the latest project of Pack's working group, which had secured $2.5 million in grants, 8 funded projects, 25 research proposals, and the opening of a center for prescription drug abuse geared toward research. And maybe even more important, it was co-led by Dr. Steve Lloyd, a charismatic physician with local roots who had been opioid addicted himself. Located in Gray, Tennessee, a solidly middle-class community of farmers and suburbanites, with Daniel Boone High School just a mile and a half away, Overmountain fought a mighty resistance on its march to opening its doors in September 2017. Headed by a respected area farmer, citizens to maintain Gray worried that patients taking methadone would be too high to drive safely. And while the members of the group weren't exactly against the idea of the center, they didn't want it anywhere near them, even as some admitted privately to Lloyd and Pack, "My son is dealing with this." But the working group showed up and heard them out. They brought in outside police chiefs and methadone providers, giving decision makers examples and studies from other communities that overrode their safety concerns. To win near unanimous approval from the city zoning board and the state, they willingly endured more than a year of public ass-kicking. In a community of just 1,222 residents, More than 300 people had spoken out publicly against the project, some referring to Pack and Lloyd as drug lords. In recovery for more than a decade, Lloyd knew exactly how to explain himself to people in his hometown, to make them see the struggle anew. Before seeking treatment, he had doctor-shopped his own colleagues, stolen from relatives' medicine cabinets, and even faked an ankle injury so he could have orthopedic surgery and get discharged with painkillers. His father called him out on his addiction in 2004 and forced him to get help, funneling him into 90 days of inpatient rehab, followed by 5 years of random drug screens, support services, and intensive monitoring. A key component of Lloyd's success was a threat of punishment. His medical license could be yanked if he relapsed and/or made a critical medical error while treating a patient. He still checks in daily for the possibility of a random drug screen via an app on his cell phone, even though he's now Tennessee's Assistant Commissioner for Substance Abuse Services. The daily routines of his life as a recovering addict and physician keep him committed to recovery, just as the scar on his left ankle reminds him how desperately low the drug addicted can go. Though Lloyd's treatment was too expensive to be replicated to scale, he paid $40,000 cash up front, and limited coverage is now available to those with insurance, but it would cost almost twice that today. He believes the 5-year treatment model, common for addicted doctors and airline pilots, is ideal. It's why they tend to have opioid recovery rates as high as 70 to 90%. There's nothing scientific at all about 28 days of residential treatment, Lloyd said of the kind heralded in movies and on reality TV. It takes the frontal lobe, the insight and judgment part that's been shut down by continued drug use, at least 90 days just to start to come back online, and sometimes 2 years to be fully functioning. But most users don't have access to 90 days of treatment, much less 2 years. Only 1 in 10 addicted Americans gets any treatment at all for his or her substance use disorder, which is why there's such a push for outpatient MAT and increasingly programs that divert the addicted from jail to treatment. While drug courts rightly provide not only intensive monitoring but also the threat of a swift jail sentence, Lloyd believes that all people in recovery, especially those who relapse, should be allowed MAT, even if they have to sue to get it. The judges who don't allow it are in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. They just are, he said. Denying opioid-addicted participants medicine they have legitimately been prescribed is akin to denying diabetics their insulin on the grounds that they're fat. If 90% of people with diabetes were unable to access medical treatment, there would be rioting in the streets. Lloyd made his MAT argument repeatedly as he tried to sell the idea of Overmountain to the doubters in gray, 10 minutes down the road from his Boone's Creek hometown. The crowd was tougher than he anticipated. To intimidate him, they filmed him as he spoke. They yelled, "Put it in your neighborhood," and placed condemning signs in the hands of their 10-year-old children as they marched. At one meeting, Lloyd tried to explain the science behind addiction, that it was a chronic brain disease and relapses were to be expected. When a woman in the audience interrupted to ask, "Just how many chances are we supposed to give somebody?" He tried to appeal to the group's humanity, as Gaeta had done in Boston, pointing out that addiction already was in their neighborhood. Simply turning their heads away out of fear or sanctimonious denial was equivalent to enabling the spread of overdose deaths, quite possibly even in their own families. From the community center where he stood, in the heart of the Bible Belt, Steve Lloyd could make out 4 church steeples. He had played ball and gone to Sunday school with many of the people in the room. There were leaders here and elsewhere who agreed with the woman he knew, including an Ohio sheriff who'd recently proposed taking naloxone away from his deputies, claiming that repeated overdose reversals were, quote, "sucking the taxpayers dry." Lloyd thought immediately of the answer Jesus gave when his disciple asked him to enumerate the concept of forgiveness. Should it be granted 7 times, Peter wanted to know, or should a sinner be forgiven as many as 70 times? In the shadow of the church steeples, Lloyd let Jesus answer the woman's question. 70 times 7, he said. If the federal government wouldn't step in to save Appalachia, if it steadfastly refused to elevate methods of treatment, research, and harm reduction over punishment in jail, Appalachia would have to save itself. Epilogue. Soldier's Disease. Back in my adopted hometown of Roanoke, where I'd been following families for going on 6 years, the addicted people I came to know were in widely ranging states of wellness, some far more fragile than others. Their relatives were worn out. Many seemed to age before my eyes, like a video on fast forward. The day his mother arrived to pick him up from the Petersburg, Virginia penitentiary in February 2017, Spencer Mumpower was exuberant when he spotted her walking toward him. "I want to run to you, but I still have these prison clothes on, and I'm afraid they'll shoot me," he shouted, only half-joking. "That's okay," Ginger hollered back. "I'll run to you." There was almost no weekend since Spencer began his prison sentence in 2012 when she hadn't visited him in federal prison and or put money on his commissary account. Almost no month in which she had not tried to coax prosecutors, lawyers, politicians, probation officers, and even judges to grant her only son an early release. That August, exactly a year after my prison interview with Ronnie Jones, Ginger left her Roanoke jewelry store, located on the fringes of Hidden Valley, and drove to a North Carolina halfway house to pick up Spencer, who had been living there for 6 months since his prison release. He was free to finally leave his confinement, all exquisitely toned 165 pounds of him, with a body that could deadlift 500 pounds in sets of 5 reps. Sober for 7 years, Spencer had replaced his heroin and methamphetamine addiction with martial arts even before he'd left for federal prison. The jiu-jitsu practice had sustained him throughout his incarceration, even when his girlfriend dumped him, and when his former martial arts teacher and one-time father figure was arrested and jailed for taking indecent liberties with a teenage female student. Spencer stuck to his recovery and to his prison workouts, ignoring the copious drugs that had been smuggled inside, and he read voraciously about mixed martial arts. Using the Bureau of Prisons' limited email system, he had Ginger copy articles about various MMA fighters, laboriously pasting in one block of text at a time, so he could memorize pro tips and workout strategies and eventually, through her, reach out directly to fighters and studio owners for advice. If all goes well, Spencer will be taking the geographic cure when he moves to another Virginia city, which he doesn't care to name, to work for one such studio once his probation officer signs off. While he was enjoying his new freedom, the reality of life after prison was also settling in. Prison had given him post-traumatic stress disorder, he told me, and his transition to the outside world was proving to be far harder than he'd imagined. Sleeping in a room without the lights on or anyone else nearby made him nervous, as did driving a car. Ginger drove him to the gym most days, or he took an Uber, which didn't exist in Roanoke when he left for prison in 2012. To help with his PTSD, he planned to get a service dog. Scott Ross' mom, Robin, still texted me regularly with pictures of sunflowers, along with images of Vanilla Rice pretending to cook with a sword, and another jokey one of him donning her fur coat the Christmas before he died. She texted a picture of an eighth-grade Scott, blonde and bespectacled, and wearing a classy black tux to his Catholic school dance. He'd insisted she buy him a dozen roses for the dance, not just for his date, but also for the girls who didn't have one, she wrote. A trail of sunflower emojis decorated her note. Still engulfed in her grief, Robin Roth had been mourning her son's death now for 8 years, and she was occasionally asked by his old friends for help getting into treatment, which she happily extended. She wanted me to convey both the depth of her grief and the ways in which she believed she had failed her son. She wrote to me, "I wish I could have built him a stronger support system. I thought I could do it all as a single mom. I made a mistake. Find at least 4 adults your young adult can trust and turn to. Know their names and let them know that you are counting on them to help you assist your child to make good choices. Whatever rules you make, you better stick to them. Your son or daughter depends on it. They will call your bluff on everything. Don't you budge. Changing the rules only confuses a young, developing mind. 2 years earlier, Robin had moved into an apartment, downsizing from the suburban split level where she'd raised her only child. It had been hard to leave the Hidden Valley home, the place where she'd removed all the bathroom doors, thinking that might keep Scott from shooting up, the yard where she'd grown the massive sunflower field after his death. Occasionally, stray sunflowers still sprout up in the yard of her former home, 8 feet tall, some of them, with a dozen or more blooms. They are not just memorials to Scott Roth, but also to the epidemic's intractability. The young woman who bought Robin's house had not only been addicted to heroin herself, she's been sober now for more than 4 years, but her sister, 27-year-old Joey Gilbert, is the one who relapsed and died in March 2017, despite the Hope Initiative Angel's Herculean efforts to help her. Had Joey had access to Medicaid health insurance and a clear path forward for continuing her MAT, her family firmly believes she'd be alive today. In the fall of 2017, I sat down again with the Hope Initiative director, Janine Underwood, Bobby's mom, who grew more despairing by the day. All the overdoses and all the deaths, none of it seemed to inspire more awareness of the tragedy or its toll on families, many of whom were still cowering in shame. Bobby's old friends continued showing up to Hope every week. Some had been using for almost a decade, and she said they are so, so very tired of the way they're living, and yet they were so equally afraid to give it up. One friend, a 30-year-old man, had broken down when he realized Janine was Bobby's mom. Though his mother had driven him to the Hope Clinic from the suburban ranch house turned meth lab where he now lived, she was so ashamed that she waited outside in her car. Amanda, a young woman who once babysat for Bobby's sister, showed up recently at Hope too, determined to get sober. But by the time Janine and Hope volunteer Nancy Hans went to her home to help arrange a transfer to detox, Amanda was nodding out. During a brief coherent moment, she pulled out her Hidden Valley High yearbook, pointing to a homecoming dance picture of herself and her friends. 3 of the 5 were now active heroin users, she said, her voice slurring as she spoke. Then, abruptly, she pointed to the window. "Look, it's raining," she said. "That's Bobby looking down on us." Nancy and Janine made dozens of phone calls to get Amanda into the Community Services Board-run detox. Janine even drove her to the facility, but it wasn't yet providing buprenorphine for detox, and Amanda left after just 12 hours saying she couldn't take the pain of being dope sick. By the time the women lined up a facility that would allow her to be on MAT, Amanda had fled to New York, partly to avoid an upcoming court date for drug charges. A few days later, she overdosed on fentanyl-laced heroin in Central Park, where EMS workers revived her and let her go. The last Janine heard from Amanda, she had taken off for New Jersey, where she was now trading sex for drugs. Unlike the Tennessee Tri-Cities collaboration that had birthed Over Mountain, Roanoke had not created a working group to transcend bureaucratic logjams, but perhaps in time it would. Non-fatal overdoses in 2017 had more than doubled the previous year's counts, and fatal overdoses had nearly tripled, and those figures were likely an undercount. At a sparsely attended public forum at Tessa's alma mater, police recounted the August 2017 seizure of 4.4 pounds of fentanyl along I-81, enough for 1 million fatal overdoses. They'd also recently arrested a Cave Spring High graduate attempting to sell 700 Xanax bars at the local community college that contained fentanyl he'd mail-ordered via the dark web from Hong Kong. Ronnie Jones was right again. Shit had not stopped at all. But with continued regional media cutbacks, the Roanoke Times was down to just a single Roanoke Valley police reporter, and there were now sprawling heroin ring prosecutions that received zero media attention. The public was left to believe that it had. Warren Bickel, the world-class addiction researcher, had just nabbed a $1 million grant for his Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute to pilot new MAT protocols for the streamlining of ER to outpatient transfers. Patients who overdose would be directly connected to outpatient buprenorphine via a newly FDA-approved, once-monthly injection called Sublocade. Bickel had recently lost a family friend to overdose. The young man had been taking Suboxone, but when he tested positive for additional opioids during a follow-up visit, his doctor cut his Suboxone dosage back as punishment. What he needed was an increased dose, not less, Bickel said. When I told Bickel that Tess was still living homeless on the streets of Las Vegas, paying for illicit drugs with sex work, he called up a study he'd co-authored in 1988. Showing that buprenorphine definitively protects the addicted from overdose death and leads to reduced crime and better health. Holy mackerel, this is such an old study, but people still aren't aware, he said. The Community Services Board in Roanoke had recently added MAT treatment for 21 patients, but only if they first engaged in counseling. Carilion still had a 3-week wait for its outpatient MAT. When I floated the idea at a Carilion-sponsored forum that every doctor who'd accepted a Purdue Pharma freebie should feel morally compelled to become waivered to prescribe Suboxone as a way to beef up treatment capacity, the response among the doctors in the room was crickets. As Philadelphia edged closer to launching the nation's first supervised safe injection facility, efforts to start a syringe exchange program in Roanoke remained sluggish and mired in politics, even as the Rural Health Department Director, Dr. Sue Cantrell, finally won permission to open one in Wise, in the most conservative part of the state. The Virginia General Assembly seemed on the verge of passing a Medicaid expansion, finally, but with the provision that the able-bodied be required to work. The changes weren't trickling down fast enough for Tess. When I told her mom about the limited MAT expansions in the fall of 2017, paid for via state and federal grants, she called the Community Services Board office and was told that only pregnant women were being accepted at the time. Soon after, Tess messaged me at 4 a.m. from someone else's phone, saying she planned to enter another Nevada rehab and asking if I'd send her more books when she got there. I texted back that I already had the new David Sedaris book ready to send. Oh, awesome, she said, thanking me for my positivity and support. She didn't have an address where she could receive the book, but she would let me know when she checked herself into a rehab. Her elderly grandfather had agreed to fund another round of treatment, even though Tess had recently talked him into wiring her $500, allegedly to pay a friend to drive her back to Roanoke. Her mother said, he knew he was being played, but he loves her so much, and he was probably thinking, what if she's hungry? Patricia had learned about her dad's cash transfer after the fact. Though the ploy was likely another con for drug money, Patricia was buoyed by Tessa's having reached out to her family and me and updating her Facebook page with pictures of her son. Unknown to us at the time, Tess had applied for Medicaid in Nevada, which expanded access in 2014 under the ACA, another indication that she was actively seeking treatment and MAT. The problem is we don't even know where she is, or worse, what pimp and/or drug dealer she was now beholden to, her mother said. In a November 2017 phone call, Tess was hopped up on crystal meth, Patricia believed, and paranoid that, quote, gang stalkers were trying to kill her. As she walked down the streets of Las Vegas, she thought people in passing cars were flashing their lights at her. She thought strangers were shouting her son's name. Patricia told me, all Tess has to do is tell us where she is, and the treatment people will come and pick her up. Of the 132 addicted users who had come to the HOPE Initiative in its first year, fewer than 10 had gone to residential treatment and stayed sober. But Patricia still slept with her cell phone every night, waiting and praying that Tess would one day be among them. In early December, Tess seemed better, judging from sporadic text messages and calls to her mom. She decided to make her way home to Roanoke. though her plans for the journey were vague. Patricia lined up a bed at an abstinence-only treatment center 15 minutes from her home. Tessa's grandfather agreed to cover the flight and rehab, and Patricia spent a week navigating the Department of Motor Vehicles bureaucracy to get Tess a temporary ID that would allow her to board an airplane. But where to send the ID? Tess was still homeless, and another week passed.